Malolele, you're listening to Dateline from RNZ Pacific. I'm Koroi Hawkins. Coming up...
Are we making the necessary policy and behavioral change to keep us on the 1.5 degree pathway?
Pacific leaders call for more ambitious climate action.
None of us have ever been trained to run a point in the Pacific.
Tonga reflects on struggles to remain COVID-19 free 1 year into the pandemic, and compensation claims for victims of French nuclear weapons tests are on track despite a new report. Pacific leaders are warning the world is on red alert when it comes to the climate crisis. A global stocktake has warned the Earth's atmosphere will heat up by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels unless nations produce tougher policies. The UK-based New Climate Institute says some countries have yet to submit a climate plan, and others, such as Australia, are judged to have offered no substantial improvement on their previous proposals. Christine Ravoy reports.
While COVID-19 continues to dominate global attention and resources, the Pacific is still facing the existential threat of climate change. In its latest report released last week, the New Climate Institute warned governments that they needed to halve emissions by 2030 if they wanted to keep global warming within 1.5 degrees of pre-industrial levels. This is the threshold recommended by scientists to reduce the adverse impacts of climate change. A set of national climate policies submitted to the recent COP26 Pacific Islands Roundtable on Urgent Climate Change had claimed that meeting their targets would see emissions stabilized by 2030. But Pacific leaders are warning the planet is already on a climate red alert. Kausea Natano is the Prime Minister of Tuvalu, one of the islands on the front line of the climate crisis. He says in 2019 alone, the climate disaster cost the world $150 billion, and yet carbon dioxide levels are at record highs and rising.
The latest scientific evidence shows that this is causing our seas to rise, our oceans to warm, and is increasing the intensity of extreme weather events, inflicting damage and destruction on our peoples, our ecosystems, economies, and country.
Fiji's Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama warned of the dangers of high-polluting countries not curtailing their greenhouse gas emissions and committing to meaningful net-zero targets.
I refuse to let Fijians and our Pacific Island sisters and brothers be some sacrificial canary for coal-burning countries and high-emitting companies. We must not stand idly by and watch the world's most vulnerable countries suffer, only to warn other wealthier nations that their own fate will soon follow. This is not just Fiji's climate emergency. It is the world's emergency.
Bainimarama's Samoan counterpart, Tuila Epa Sailele Malia-Ngangoi, says the Kainaki 2 Declaration calls on the international community to join the Blue Pacific and take bold, decisive and transformative action.
We cannot allow COVID-19 to disrupt ambitious climate action. These are vital to planning and owning our development agenda and to building the resilience of the Pacific, particularly in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Nauru's President Lionel Angimia says with 5 years gone since the Paris Agreement, the world is still facing an unprecedented climate war. And for the Pacific, Angimia says the situation is becoming dire.
There is no disputing the science or the impacts that we have experienced, which will most likely worsen if we continue on this trajectory. We need ambitious climate change action now, not 5, 10 or 50 years into the future, but immediately if we are to secure our children's future.
Kausea Natano, who is also chair of the Pacific Islands Forum, says in 2020, the upward gas emission trends continued despite the COVID-19 pandemic.
5 years on, we must now ask ourselves, are we making the necessary policy and behavioral change to keep us on the 1.5 degree pathway? From the perspective of the Blue Pacific, the answer is simple. No, we are not.
Pacific leaders have committed to energy transition ahead of the Global Climate Conference in the UK in November. COP26 Chief Alok Sharma says the message coming from regions like the Pacific has a moral urgency. And Mr. Sharma says the world cannot ignore it.
I hear what you say, that climate change is the single greatest threat to the livelihoods, security and well-being of your people. And I'm committed to working with you throughout my COP presidency to make sure that your voices are heard, to address the issues that matter most to you, and to find practical solutions.
The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, is on the same page as Pacific leaders, saying governments are nowhere close to the level of ambition needed to limit climate change to 1.5 degrees and meet the goals of the Paris Treaty. Guterres wants the world's major emitters to step up with much more ambitious targets on their emission reductions. Ko Christine Ravoy, Aho.
Health authorities in Tonga say they are proud of the effort put in to keep COVID-19 out of the country 1 year into the pandemic. The chief executive of the Ministry of Health, Dr. Siale Akaula, says like many other Pacific countries, Tonga was anxious when news of a new coronavirus started surfacing last year. 12 months later, and Tonga is one of the dwindling number of countries that continues to remain free of COVID-19. Even throughout the repatriation of Tongan citizens, which started in July 2020. Our reporter, Sarah Jane Hopgood, spoke with Dr. Akaula about their efforts, and she joins me now. Malele Sela, so what did Dr. Akaula say about their approach when this all kicked off about this time last year?
Dr. Siale Akaula told me that what worried Tonga in the beginning of this whole pandemic was watching a lot of developed wealthy countries like France, who are well-resourced medically, struggle to contain the virus. And so immediately Tonga thought, right, we don't want that to happen to us because we are a very small nation. And so Dr. Akaula, he was so grateful for the government and other key partners for supporting the Ministry of Health with their COVID-19 plans, especially given this is a new virus.
Right from the start, we had very good support from government. The cabinet, our National Emergency Management Committee, they were all supporting Ministry of Health and behind the plans that we had developed together with other key partners within the government. And of course, the general public, they supported. They saw that they didn't, none of the people in power wanted COVID-19. And I'm sure it was the same throughout the Pacific.
And what was the hardest part in terms of managing the health response for Tonga?
So Dr. Akaula says the hardest thing for him and his team was the new restrictions they had to introduce to Tongans, such as quarantine.
The need to have quarantine. I mean, we talk about quarantining people as a thing that happened in the early 1900s. Now we are confronted with the actual mechanisms and actual need to do it at a time and age. And none of us have ever been trained to run a quarantine facility for people. And to me, that was a challenge to all of us, you know, trying to contain people because you're taking their rights away from them.
And were there any other challenges that Tonga faced?
Yeah, there have been other costly challenges for the country, such as businesses struggling, in particular the tourism industry, and the inability to travel. And then there are Tongans who are stranded around the world trying to get home. Repatriation flights happen every 3 weeks, so that's dependent on how other countries manage COVID-19 cases. So there are delays in getting passengers home. And a clear example is this week, New Zealand has a community outbreak and Tonga has had to postpone the flight for Wednesday, the 3rd of March, to another date. However, Dr. Akaula is staying positive and he considers Tonga to be in a good position for getting their country operating in a new normal.
We are still free of the virus and now we are discussing about the vaccine, which is, it is nice. It is a nice time to be in a region of the world where we're discussing vaccines when we don't have massive outbreaks and people are dying left, right and centre.
And that was Chief Executive of Tonga's Ministry of Health, Dr. Siale Akaula, who spoke with our reporter, Sela Jane Hopgood. Maloa pito, Sela.
Maloa pito, Kuroe.
The compensation programme for victims of France's nuclear weapons tests remains on track. This is despite a new report in France, which says there are not enough elements to establish a link between the weapons tests and illnesses. But veterans groups in Tahiti are concerned, accusing Paris of negotiationism. My colleague Walter Zweifel has been following this controversy and I asked him what the report said.
The French National Institute of Health and Medical Research said its experts examined almost 1,200 reports and documents and found that it was not conclusive that atmospheric tests caused illnesses such as cancers in French Polynesia. The INSEM report also stated that the data does not disprove a link. However, they suggested that illnesses could be the result of other factors such as smoking, excessive alcohol consumption or obesity. The report noted that the incidence of cancers was roughly the same as in France, but much higher in the case of thyroid disorders. It also noted that New Caledonia had very high rates of thyroid cancers, attributed there mainly to asbestos in the natural environment. The report was, by the way, commissioned by the French Defence Ministry in 2013.
And how did the veterans group react to this?
Well, predictably, they see this as a continued denial of the plight of the victims. While the latest report seems to be neither supportive nor dismissive, it fits into the experience that France is slow in owning up to this test legacy. One group says this was nothing new, and it strained credulity that the equivalent of 800 Hiroshima bombs had no impact. An opposition politician said the documents were controlled by the military, and a historian questioned whether the information was a continuation of lies that had been dished up earlier.
And will this affect the compensation program?
According to the head of the agency, known as Sivan, the criteria have not changed and France will keep reimbursing victims. Alain Krisnach, the head of Sivan, said the committee has 10 million euros a year to pay out, and he says more claims are now being accepted. To look back in 2019, Sivan accepted 62 compensation claims lodged in French Polynesia, while in the period from 2010 to 2017, only 11 were accepted. What is notable is that the French state is not liable because there is any proof that the state was directly responsible for the damage. The payments, which are made through Sivan, are defined as money given out of national solidarity and not because there is any liability.
And how come there used to be so few cases accepted?
For one, until 2010, France's official line was that its nuclear tests were clean, and then it set strict conditions which practically excluded all applicants. It then changed the system 4 years ago by abolishing exposure criteria, which in turn were found to contradict the existing legislation, and new terms were adopted. A Tahitian politician in favour of the now tighter rules said otherwise a French smoker, for example, who had cancer, was eligible for compensation if they had spent time in Tahiti. From French Polynesia's perspective, the nuclear legacy is really costly. The healthcare system in Tahiti, known as the CPS, claims to have paid out almost $800 million on healthcare costs for people deemed to have radiation-induced illnesses. And just over a year ago, the CPS said over 9,500 people have been taken care of for cancers caused by the nuclear tests.
Finally, what's the state of Mururoa now?
It's still a military no-go zone. Although the weapons test stopped in 1996, France has refused to return the excised atoll to French Polynesia. A very expensive monitoring system was installed as there are fears that the atoll could collapse and trigger a tidal wave. In 2014, a resolution by the Territorial Assembly demanded that France pay almost $1 billion in compensation for the test, which at the time the pro-independence opposition leader Oscar Temaro described as a crime against humanity.
So this report was commissioned by the French Defence Ministry. Has there ever been an independent investigation and report into the French nuclear testing in the Pacific?
Well, the same documents have been used by CIRAD, which is an independent organization set up after the Chernobyl disaster, and they, using the same documents, came to the conclusion that there was a link. So the findings can be disputed. And then, of course, there are more studies in the pipeline. There is question whether deformation in the Gombe Islands seen among children and behavioral problems, whether they are linked to the nuclear tests. There was the top psychologist in French Polynesia a couple of years ago who came out with the conclusion that there was a link, which, of course, caused an absolute outcry in French Polynesia. They then tried to find an expert to look into a genetic impact of these tests. They found a Japanese specialist and tried to hire her, but because the issue was so politicized, she declined. So the question is still there if there is a genetic link between this behavioral issue seen among children in the Gombe Island and the nuclear tests that were carried out in the region.
Vinaka Walter, that's our senior RNZ Pacific journalist, Walter Zweifel. And that's Dateline from RNZ Pacific. There's more on our website, rnzi.com. And you can listen to this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Au revoir.